from Radio Vermont, it's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV. It's your show about the people, places, and the issues that matter the most to you. Now here's your host, Dave Graham.
Good morning, Vermont. It is Tuesday, June the 30th, 2020, and we have a good show lined up for you this morning. We're going to be speaking first off with an old WD friend, James Ellers, is going to be visiting with us, and I think talking mainly about the F-35 flights, the fighter jet flights in and out of the Vermont National Air Guard base in Burlington. A lot of concern there that, you know, there's a lot of speculation leading up until their arrival last fall. Since then, there's just been a pretty loud drumbeat of concern from the community about just how loud these planes really are. And not sure what folks think ought to be done about it, but there is a lot of concern that we'll be hearing some of that from Mr. Ellers. I do believe in the second half hour, we're going to be visiting with Tracy Dolan. She is Deputy Commissioner of the Vermont Department of Health. Wanted to get an update on our COVID-19 situation in the state. Governor Scott is continuing on his path of, I guess you'd call it, careful opening of the economy. And we are, of course, everyone's looking with alarm at some of the figures and the scene on the national picture here, which is really quite concerning. Here it is coming into high summer around the United States, and the COVID-19 virus is not going away. In fact, on the contrary, we'll find out about some of that from Tracy Dolan in the second half hour of the program this morning. Later on, we're going to be visiting with Dan Richardson. He's our legal analyst, a very active attorney in Montpelier, former president of the Vermont Bar Association, and an all-around good guy. And Dan is going to be talking with us about a very important Supreme Court decision yesterday relating to abortion rights, access to abortion, et cetera. And I think we'll have some interesting things to say about sort of the overall path of the Supreme Court going forward. I think there was a fairly widespread assumption among the general public that the court was really going to take a sharp turn to the right after the appointments of Neil Gorsuch and Brett Kavanaugh. And there are some reasons that the court is it's sort of like turning a battleship. You know, it doesn't turn on a dime. And that we'll be talking with Dan about that in the second half hour. In between, we'll be getting a visit from one of our reporters at Axios. Axios is one of the national teams we go to sometimes for some perspective on what's going on out there in the broader country and world. And I believe we are going to be talking this morning with Ursula Pernow of Axios. So she may be, I think she's a first-time visitor to the Dave Graham Show, so I'm looking forward to that. And anyway, let's get right into it with James Ellers, who's on the line with us this morning. Good morning, James.
Good morning, Dave.
I wanted to check in with you about the F-35, I think we may have to have a broader conversation about this at some point, bringing in folks from the Vermont National Guard and others. There's obviously some support in the community for basing these planes in Burlington. They do generate some economic activity, and heaven knows in this pandemic time we need some economic activity. But I think people are also really kind of surprised at. I mean, there was a lot of speculation and prediction and studies indicating these planes are going to be louder than the old F-16s. But I think now that they're there, there's some growing reaction of, holy cow, are these things loud? What can you tell me?
Well, first off, Dave, I'm going to let the economic activity assertion slide for the moment. Economically benefiting whom? You know, it's the big question. But this morning, you wanted to focus on the noise issue, and I would strongly encourage you to get the Guard and some other folks I'm going to recommend whose work I'm going to cite this morning, like Scott Decker and Jimmy Lees and Professor Rankin, a physics professor from UVM, to come on the show and facilitate that dialogue. In fact, I wish WDEV and yourself would host a public debate, because right now our voices are being marginalized. And I think that's a nice way to put it. Even the National Guard General Knight when he's hosting town halls, as he is tonight, you have to submit your questions in advance so he can decide whether or not he wants to answer them. So we don't really have much recourse other than opportunities like this, Dave, because the politicians, and that is the other major aspect of this, Mayor Weinberger, Governor Scott in particular, we don't have enough time to get into all the issues with Senator Leahy's neglect, and Senator Sanders for that matter. But what we were told, and we knew this wasn't true at the time, was that the noise wasn't going to be an issue. The 35s are going to be louder, but not that much louder. And I'm not your normal, what's the pejorative they use for people who oppose military and that sort of thing, what they call snowflakes. I mean, I'm not your average snowflake. I'm a veteran. I used to work in logging. I'm just a loud noise. Did I lose you?
Well, yeah. No, I'm here. I just so you're used to loud noises, and you are not a typical snowflake, is what you're telling me.
That's how they refer to us. I've received all sorts of negative comments and slurs directed at me since taking a position against the basing of these aircraft here. But the long and short of it is, the noise here is blistering, and the second aspect of that is the airport commissioner's willful collusion with the National Guard to avoid having to measure the noise, because they know if they had the sound measurements, and we have them from an electrical engineer, of course they'll be disputed, they're willful.
Well, let me ask you about those sound measurements, because I saw that you emailed a sound sample, which taken in and of itself, I mean, I guess it somewhat depends on how loud you have your computer turned up or something, but it didn't blow me away the way it might have been hoped it would. But and I know you sent this out to other media people yesterday as well, and this is what kind of got me interested in this whole topic this morning. But you also included this a chart with the materials you sent out, and the chart indicated that there are noise spikes from that were measured here of up to 125 decibels. I believe is that what I saw?
Yeah, 124.
Okay.
The electrical engineer who's been doing the sound measurements for us even had a spike as loud as 129, and those are considered extremely dangerous by the Air Force itself. And I mean, that's again probably the most upsetting aspect of this is our local politicians and our National Guard, which is supposed to be serving us, our local Guard unit, is ignoring the Air Force's own environmental impact statement. So, you know, this really is being just jammed down our throats because Senator Leahy, wanted this to happen. And Mayor mm-hmm. Weinberger's a loyal soldier of the senators. I believe he's even a past staff member, clerk, something to that effect.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, so... And the airport director is exchanging emails with the Guard wing commander, celebrating their collaborative partnership, while the airport director, Mr. Richards, is sending in flawed grant applications for noise monitoring equipment knowingly.
Yeah.
And
yep.
Jimmy Lee's an activist in Burlington who's been a real leader on this issue, and we're really grateful to have his work. He's documented all this with a public records request from the city of Burlington. So, you know, the noise is an issue, but what's even more concerning to me personally is just the lack of integrity of our neighbors. you know, our guard officials and our Burlington mayor and the airport director.
Well, I'll tell you, James. The thing I get concerned about on a more kind of ground level issue here is just I'm picking up conversations in the community just from random people, some of whom are not rabid liberal peacenik snowflake activists or whatever. You know, I mean, they're just people.
By the way,
they're just people trying to get through their day. You know,
right.
And so, you know, I know people who go to classes at the CCV, the Community College of Vermont campus, right there in downtown Winooski. And, you know, valuable class time is lost when these planes are flying overhead and nobody can hear the instructor speaking.
Well, there's that. And you mentioned economic activity at the outset. I mean, it impairs learning. We know that. We know that these noise disruptions impair learning. There's solid science on that. We've got elementary schools. We have high schools. It's not just CCV that are squarely in the flight path of these weapons. So
the other aspect of this is we're you know, with the, especially with the COVID-19 crisis, we're living in this age of telemedicine and Zoom meetings for all kinds of businesses and et cetera. So you, now you're on a Zoom meeting, and one of the members of your Zoom meeting, I guess they have to mute or something because all of a sudden they have these planes flying overhead and they can't speak, they can't be heard, they can't hear. Nothing is happening as far as getting any business or economic activity done for those minutes when these flights are happening. And... You know, I guess I don't know whether anybody's really added up the amount of lost time in the metropolitan Burlington area that happens as a result here. But telemedicine is another one. I mean, these are just stories I pick up randomly from people I talk to in the community. But
right.
we have this whole big push on right now. For folks who are checking in with their physicians or whatever to do it by telephone or by a video chat of some kind, and that comes to a halt. And you know, now we're talking about doctor time. That's worth a couple hundred bucks an hour, and when that gets lost to a racket that just completely stops the meeting.
That's an interesting perspective that I hadn't even considered, because here in Winooski, I live in Winooski in an apartment. Mm-hmm. I just basically don't commit myself to online meetings or anything else, because you just never know when you're going to have this disruption, because it's not just the stoppage, it's the disruption in your thinking and your thought process. And if you're engaged in some high-level critical thinking, it's not conducive to making good decisions, sound decisions. And I know I'm not the only one. From a retail perspective, for a community like Winooski that has worked very, very, very hard to revitalize itself, I know people who are not interested any longer in coming to Winooski to enjoy the outdoor restaurants, because again, 124 decibels. Let's say it's 100 decibels. For many people, that's painful to experience. Mm-hmm. And I know we'll get mocked, but there's also this aspect of the F-35s that's different, and that's the low frequency noise that literally causes vibrations. You know, the sound waves move air, and that includes our chest cavities, internal organs, and, you know, my fellow brothers and sisters in the service, they know this, you know, and the military has very strict guidelines on the amount of exposure that we can have to these vibrations. I mean, my last deployment in the Navy, there was a few inches of steel between me and a flight deck, so... I understand what people are dealing with, and these these planes do not belong at a civilian airport in residential neighborhoods. People can argue about whether or not we want these for other reasons, but these planes, all their other safety issues aside, I mean, they've just been banned from flying within, I believe it's 25 nautical miles of a thunderstorm because they may explode if struck by lightning. This just released in the last couple days. There are issues with Lockheed's supply chain and their replacement parts being the unreliability issues there. There's a reason why warplanes are typically based in lightly populated areas with large security perimeters around them. We don't even have an APZ, an accident potential zone here, that is protective of the Winooski kids at the school. So there's so many issues with this plane, and the only way that this plane could have landed here, bad pun intended, was when you have the most senior Democrat in the United States Senate, ranking member, vice chair of the Senate Appropriations Committee, who also happens to be co-chair of the Senate National Guard Caucus. And that is the only reason this plane is here. It is not here for strategic national defense reasons. The Air Force wasn't even interested in locating it here. It's here because Senator Leahy wanted it here for his own political purposes, and he has enlisted his loyal party soldiers to have these aircraft quartered, quite literally. You know, it's interesting, and that makes me think to remind you that there is a rally on Saturday, on July 4th, organized by the People for Peace and Security, Veterans for Peace, Women's International League of Peace and Freedom, on July 4th, and they intend to list demands that they're going to post on Mayor Weinberger's door, Senator Sanders' door, Senator Leahy's door, and Congressman Welch's door.
When and where is the rally?
4 to 6, beginning at Burlington City Hall.
And I do believe we have a listener on the line this morning, Annette's calling in from Danby. Good morning, Annette. Annette, are you there?
The levels being measured are 120. Whoa. I had to learn a lot about noise dealing with wind turbines. I can go to a website and their noise monitoring, there's noise monitoring equipment, and it's at many, many airports all around the world, and I can go and look in real time and see what the levels are. That's a really sort of standard thing to have at airports, and pilots are actually charged a penalty if they exceed those noise limits. So I'm.
What are typical noise limits, Annette?
40, 50, 60, 70, you know, nothing like 120. I pulled up a chart. Jet takeoff, which is similar to a power lawnmower, 100. When you get up to 110, average human pain threshold, when you get up to 120, that's like running a chainsaw without any noise equipment, and that's considered painful. But when you get up to 150, that's eardrum rupture. I mean, these noise levels are exceedingly high, and that there isn't a monitoring system that the National Guard has put in, or the airport has put in, that's actually standard at most places. It's really, you know, this is not going well. And I did hear the F-35s when they made their run around the state. I was blown away by how loud they were. And I remember the F-15s used to come around here, but I cannot imagine what it's like living with it on a daily basis. And I'm really glad that James is bringing some attention to this.
All right. Thanks for the call, Annette. I appreciate it. Let's go to Jimmy in South Burlington. Good morning, Jimmy.
Good morning.
Hey, Dave. Hey, Dave. Hey, Jimmy, before we get on to Jimmy, because Jimmy should have a show of his own on this topic, I just wanted to point out and thank Annette for bringing up the issue of wind turbines, because that low-frequency noise emitted by turbines is very similar to what we're experiencing with the 35s, and it's not being measured, it's not being acknowledged by the guard, by the airport, who uses these average A-weighted ratings for sound measurement over a 24-hour period. We don't hear sound averaged over 24 hours. We hear it in the moment,
yeah.
And it
right.
is painful. Our ears ring sometimes, and we have headaches for days if we're caught outside without the ability to protect ourselves.
Are folks up there buying ear protection as part of just their daily routine? They walk around outside, they wear ear coverings that some construction workers wear, or
it's not possible, and it's not, especially in a low-income community like Winooski, where we don't have climate-controlled apartments, which the people in leadership keep saying, "Oh, we're just going to insulate everyone's homes that they haven't demolished." You can't. There's no way for us to insulate homes when we don't have air conditioning.
Let me bring in Jimmy because we just have a couple of minutes to go, James. So Jimmy Lee's, I think it is. Is that right?
That's right. So I just wanted good morning. I just wanted to talk about who has the power over these training flights. It is the federal government under the Constitution that arms the militia, but the Constitution also reserves to the states the authority over training the militia. So our state has the power to start or stop or regulate the training, and these are training flights. All of these flights of the F-35 are for training our National Guard. So this is under the authority of the state, particularly the governor. So we could actually, as a state, put a stop to the training flights of the F-35 that are causing pain and hearing damage, particularly in low-income and minority areas like Winooski, where the Air Force itself says there's disproportionate impact on black, brown, and working-class people.
I'll tell you the saddest story I've heard about on this front is a young woman who is new American. She originally is from Iraq. She's a student up in the Burlington area, and from what I'm told, she hears these planes, and they remind her of the planes that dropped a bomb on her home when she was a small child and killed some of her siblings and her mother, and she is freaking out, basically, every time one of these goes over. That's quite a sad tale.
Dave, what upsets me as a veteran about hearing that story is that person has come here to be free of that sort of oppression, and here
and terror.
We have our own government just showing a total disregard for its own people. And Jimmy's points are excellent. We wouldn't be where we are still in this issue, but were it not for Jimmy's efforts, and we're not going to go away. And General Knight really ought to consider who it is that he's serving when
it isn't just his serving. It's also military rules. The Air Force and the National Guard operate under the laws of war, which prohibit unnecessarily harming civilians without military necessity. They're supposed to observe.
Guys, you know what? I hate to do this, but I kind of have to leave it there because we're about out of time for this segment. But I want to revisit this issue. I think it's an ongoing thing that needs more attention. I do want to get I'll offer a chance for somebody from the Guard, somebody from maybe Senator Leahy, Governor Scott's office, to come on and talk about this. It's an ongoing thing. Gentlemen, thank you so much for joining me. I also appreciate the calls from Annette and of course, Jimmy. And we'll be back after a brief break for some bottom-of-the-hour news on the Dave Graham Show here on WDEV, FM, and AM. Stay with us, folks.
We're opening upstairs at the Warren store. Following CDC guidelines, we will allow 3 people at a time from 10 to 4 Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, and 11 to 3 Monday and Thursday until further notice. Or you can email Lori, L-O-R-I, at warrenstore.com to make an appointment. There's lots of great summer clothing at 50% off outside and new spring merchandise upstairs. Please wear a mask. We have disposables, and we will be selling organic wired ones from Product Think Tank. We'd love to see you. Stay safe. Main Street, Warren Village.
It's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV.
We are back and going to be talking, I do believe, this half hour with Tracy Dolan, the Deputy Commissioner of the Vermont Department of Health, hoping to get an update on what is going on in Vermont with the COVID-19 virus. And there's a lot of concern nationally of what's happening out there in the broader United States of America relating to the COVID-19, because this pandemic is really roaring, especially in some of the Sunbelt states right now. But it seems to be at the constant ready to pop up again in places where maybe we thought we had it under control and pretty well in check. There are a lot of folks out there who are minimizing this thing. They're not wearing their masks. They are not maintaining the social distancing that is recommended by public health experts. And that's how you get this stuff to spread. And some of the states that were first to reopen way back in April are basically the ones that are now being hit hardest by resurgences of this pandemic. And and again, you know, nobody wants to catch this thing. This is a very dangerous and ugly situation if you are affected by the coronavirus. Here's Arizona, just for instance, is one place tops on my mind these days, because one of my sons just moved there last week. He's taking a job as a teacher out there. And it's kind of worrisome when I see you headlines like Arizona orders bars and gyms to close, joining other states in reversing reopening. Move comes on the heels of state reporting nearly 4,000 new COVID-19 cases Sunday, its largest one-day caseload so far. I mean, I think these numbers are kind of pretty daunting when you think about it from a Vermont perspective. That's a lot more. Arizona had reported way more new cases, new cases on Sunday than Vermont has had so far in the first several months of this pandemic. I do believe we are joined now by Tracy Dolan of the Vermont Department of Health, and I really appreciate her occasional visits to our show here, because she has a good perspective on what's going on statewide here and its comparison with maybe what's happening in the national trends and so on. Tracy Dolan, thank you very much for joining me this morning.
Hi, good morning, Dave. How are you today?
I'm doing pretty well. How are you?
I'm well, thank you.
So give us an update on where Vermont stands. Are we seeing any of, we see these giant resurgences or just new appearances of the COVID-19 virus especially some of the Sunbelt states, but is Vermont seeing a little bit of an uptick also?
You know, we're seeing occasional outbreaks, but our actual infection rate continues to remain pretty low. We have currently 1,208 cases, with only 2 hospitalizations, so we're fortunate in the severity of the illness. And we've had 56 deaths. But our total number of people tested is almost 65,000. So we have a case rate that is well under 2%. And we are among 4 states in the country that are actually testing at recommended levels, which is
wow.
Good news, yeah. I mean, you will see, COVID is still here. It's still just as severe and can be. We have been lucky that, we're really protecting some of our more vulnerable populations. We've been very cautious and conservative with elderly, with people in long-term care, with people who have chronic disease. And we've also really worked with hospitals to make sure that we have capacity so that people are able to get the care they need right away. So it's still a dangerous disease. However, I feel like Vermonters have really taken seriously the 4 things we're asking them to do, which is to wear masks, wash hands, socially distance, and stay home when they're sick. And so I think that's helping us.
Yeah, and is your sense that a lot of folks are just maybe more homebodies than they used to be? I mean, are people staying home even when they're not sick, and is that a good idea?
Oh, I am really noticing that. Even in my personal life, I'm talking to people who say, you know what, I kind of like being at home, it turns out, you know. I heard that this might not be good for marriages, but I have heard some couples say, you know, I kind of like my husband.
That's encouraging.
Yeah, that's encouraging, right? You got to love that. And I think just, you know, family spending a little more time together and getting into a rhythm. Certainly, it's interesting, the little niche places you see it. So I've just gotten into mountain biking, and I've been looking to buy a secondhand mountain bike. And there is just a dearth of mountain bikes right now. You can't find them. And some of that, a lot of that, is about COVID. So even getting a good used secondhand bike, they are all out because everyone is turning to hobbies that they either used to do or haven't done before, and you're seeing that with a lot of the just kind of outdoorsy things to do.
Yeah, that is interesting. I was actually had a couple folks on a couple weeks ago talking about making sourdough bread, and there are big shortages on things like flour and yeast because so many people have suddenly developed a new sourdough bread baking hobby.
Yeah, it's a thing. That is a thing. I can't believe how many people are making sourdough bread. So, I decided not to go the bread route because while I'm inside and not moving around much, I'm not sure bread is going to be a good addition to my lifestyle right now.
You're probably gonna stay in better shape if you skip the skip all the carbs and get on the mountain bike instead. So
I think sounds like you're.
But then, you know, you're the deputy commissioner of health, so I guess you got to be healthy, right? So,
That's true. That's my job. I got to be a role model.
It's your job, yeah. And I wonder though, if you have any sort of chief concerns here about the pandemic, its current posture in Vermont, or are there sort of things that the health department is watching to say, maybe you have hopes as well as concerns, but I mean, are there key signals you're looking for that'll be indicators of the trajectory of this thing going forward?
Sure. The outbreaks continue to be a concern, and when we see outbreaks, sometimes what we're finding is that there are, groups of people or communities or workplaces where the mask wearing hasn't been as consistent or something along those lines. Not always, but we're double-checking to make sure that everyone is really getting the message in a way that they can understand, that makes sense to them. So you will see in the coming days a real push to promote mask wearing. That will be one piece.
Yeah,
that's the concern that we have. And just with reopening, the sense of reopening gives people, I think, a sense that everything's okay now. It's a little better in Vermont, but we're not okay. We're not COVID-free. This is still a very serious illness. And so with reopening only works if we have really a societal compact together that says we will do this if we do all these other things. We're seeing more and more, I read a fascinating article a few days ago. Mongolia literally had one case in January. They instituted masks and did a shutdown before they even had one case. The result has been zero cases right now in Mongolia. They had one case of a traveler who came in, quarantined him, he left. There are other reasons for that, but there are other rural countries that have had a lot of cases. And so just hearing more and more now about some of the countries that picked up on these things that we're doing early, so realizing that all these things that feel relatively new to the United States are really working in other countries and can work here. But we, just because it's summer and it feels good and we've got a low death rate and a low infection rate, I mean, we take our foot off this pedal and we will be going in the wrong direction again.
So we have had 1,200 and something cases to date, right, in Vermont?
Yes. I'll have to pull up the data again. It's whatever I just said, so let me...
Right. That's okay. I mean, I know. That's... It was
1,208, yep.
Okay. And I just saw a figure that indicated Arizona had 4,000 new cases on Sunday.
I know. Yeah.
That's truly alarming. I mean, I guess, of course, it's a much bigger state, but it also, I think, to some degree, puts in perspective what Vermont is dealing with here. We're basically
4,000 cases in one day, no matter how big you are, is a tremendous number of cases. Yeah.
Yeah, that's kind of crazy. And I wonder, if you were to advise a Texas or an Arizona or a Florida on steps that maybe we've taken that have been helpful here, what would be the top thing you would say if you were talking to, I guess it's Governor Ducey in Arizona?
I think I would say look at the CDC phases. They are not where we are. We are in a phase that's farther along because we've kept our infection rate down. They are not there. They have to scale way back on the reopening. In those states, they're not ready for it, and their population isn't ready for it because they have not made those changes. And so the only reason the governor is going in this direction here in Vermont, and he's doing it very cautiously, is because we have testing, we have low infection rates, and we have a population that's complying. If any of those things slip, we may have to go in a different direction. And in these other states, they just started reopening because, I don't want to slam the other states, but some of them started reopening out of pressure. And sure, there's a tremendous amount of economic pressure, but there's really no negotiating when you've got a pandemic like this and your state is just not ready.
Yeah, that's the one thing that we got to remember all the time is the coronavirus does not care about the economy.
No, it does not.
It has no concern there whatsoever. I mean, it really has no concern for anything. It doesn't. Obviously, he doesn't have the ability to think or do anything like that. But I guess we're in a situation here where, is there an extent to which Vermont's small size has made it? I don't want to take away any credit, but I mean, have we had an easier time just because of our small population?
Yeah, and that's true for any outbreak we have here in Vermont. Because of our population, not just the size of our population, but because of our population, we're able to partner more quickly, and we're able to get things done more quickly. So some of it is about numbers, and some of it is about what the numbers allow us to do differently. So when we have any outbreak in Vermont, we can literally get to the physical location within hours, right? We can get partnerships in place right away. And there is this, I don't want to do this kind of exceptional Vermont shtick, but there is something about a mutual respect in Vermont, even though there are people who don't necessarily agree philosophically with the sense of being restricted and having to wear masks, et cetera. You see a lot of people stepping up anyway because they understand that it's the right thing to do and it's expected. And that's a very impressive thing, and I would really encourage people to continue to go in that direction, not just with the mask wearing, but with the hand washing and every other piece of it. And I think there is something about, that's your neighbor. So it's hard to other people so much when you're so close.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, it's the same spirit. I think I think my first day in Vermont, 35 years ago, a guy I was working with said to me, by the way, I just want to tell you, you never flip the bird to anybody in traffic in Vermont, because if you look again, you'll probably know them.
Yeah, no, you gotta be careful when you're in mixed companies. You start talking, because that's somebody's nephew who worked with Bernie Sanders and whoever.
Right.
There's very good things about it, and one of the great things is in a crisis, people figure out how to come together, and it's impressive.
Yeah. It is just, it's kind of woven into the fabric here. I mean, the whole communitarian town meeting tradition, et cetera. But I guess, I don't know whether there's any way to bottle that and export it to other states, but talk to me a little bit about the philosophical aspect here, because, we have people out there who consider it a real infringement on their personal liberty to be asked to wear a mask. When Montpelier passed its ordinance telling people you must wear a mask if you're going to enter local businesses, I saw stuff online where people were calling it Maskpelier and so on and so forth.
And that is the minority, though. I really want to highlight, when people get upset, they speak out, but often the voice can be louder than the actual numbers. I believe that's truly the minority. I mean, the vast majority of people. I mean, there are people going in that you would, just looking at them, if you wanted to stereotype, you'd think, huh, that person doesn't look like the kind of person who would throw on a mask, you know? And they do, and they are doing it. So I think there's a peer pressure. And enough people have died here in Vermont. I mean, 56 in Vermont in a few months from this disease is no small thing, that I think a lot of people are starting to know somebody who's either had it or become very ill or passed away, or they know mm-hmm. someone who knows someone, and or they know someone in another state. And it's really hard to keep telling yourself, this doesn't matter, this doesn't work, I'm fine, when more and more, and I think this is a good role for public health. I feel like public health has really talked about the science behind contagion. I think because we haven't had a big pandemic in a while, it's easy to forget the infectious nature and the idea that you can have an illness and pass it on, and it can affect someone else so differently. It's really hard to ignore that and know that, because I have it, and I go into a store, even if I feel fine, someone else gets it and then passes it on to grandma that they visit because we've loosened restrictions at an elder home, and now 3 weeks later, grandma's on a respirator. You know, if you make yourself stop thinking, you can stop thinking about that. But hopefully, if you allow yourself to go all the way down that path, you think, you know what? Even if I'm not sure this makes sense, I should put on this mask.
Well, I wish I knew how to make commercials, because if I did, I would make one where you have a police officer maybe donning a bulletproof vest, and a firefighter putting on all the gear they wear, a big air tank and so on, a military officer, putting on the helmet and all the other stuff they wear, and say, and have these three say, you know, we do this in the name of protecting other people. And then have somebody just putting the cloth over their mouth and nose and say, if you really honor us, you could probably do this.
Yeah. You know? And, you know, it's not just the mask wearing. That's really important. But also, we have to continue to have behavior change around social distancing. And people are out and about now, but they should not be back to business as usual. If your usual used to be going to congregated settings a lot, you still shouldn't be doing that. You shouldn't be in and out of the grocery store every day. You shouldn't be going to a lot of, you know, parties. You should really limit your gatherings. Yes, restaurants are allowing people in. Think hard before you go in and look at the numbers, right? Make sure you're social distanced, all of those things. If you're out shopping, think about doing that shopping once every 2 weeks. Like, all of those things still matter. We have only so many tools in our toolbox against this virus, and so we have to be thoughtful on a personal level. Most of us, I think, are continuing to live somewhat restricted lives, and that's going to continue probably at least through the fall, as we see a possible, you know, resurgence with the flu coming and with more people moving about.
The 4th of July is coming up this weekend, and of course that is traditionally a time for big gatherings to watch fireworks and go to cookouts and parades and all the other stuff. Of course, a lot of those public official events typically sponsored by our cities and towns have been canceled or postponed. And what are the current rules and or recommendations for people who might just be thinking about, inviting the neighborhood over for the traditional 4th of July cookout?
Yeah, we wouldn't recommend inviting the neighborhood. You may have a small social circle of people that you've started to be in touch with that, and you know how they behave, and you know what their social distancing and behaviors have been, and you've known them now and been around them for a while, and you may feel like, so, you know, because of the way they behave, you have a lower risk, and you may have a small number of people and spread out those chairs. And you're not doing big hugging or anything like that, really just continuing to distance and having smaller gatherings if you're going to have a gathering, or keep it with your family, or, you know, use that day to go out hiking or biking or gardening, but it's not going to be the same. And you know what? That part of it, I would say the work part of all of this is a brutal sacrifice, but that part of it is a smaller sacrifice, and we really have to weigh our traditions against what we're up against.
Yeah, I mean, it feels kind of counterintuitive. I got to say, in my own experience here, just in the last few weeks, there have been family members or other people I would normally hug on meeting them seeing them for the first time in months or whatever, and that's not happening. It feels kind of weird.
Oh, it does.
I mean,
yeah.
You know, so, but I mean, that's pretty much. That's the smart move, though, right? I mean, just sort of wave at them.
Absolutely. That continues to be a smart move, and particularly even if it's family with your elderly. relatives. But, yeah, anyone I'm meeting. I mean, I visited with a friend the other day, and I hadn't seen her in a while, so we sat outside at her place. And normally we'd give each other a big hug. And, we sat a solid 6 feet apart outside, and we hung out for a little while, and that's just the new normal. And honestly, you can get used to it, and it's a little hard. Hopefully you have somebody in your life that you're able to give a hug to. That's a separate mental health discussion, but
yeah.
So you might need to just hug that person more. But, yeah, it is hard. It's hard, but you kind of do get used to it. I'm finding myself not having to remind myself not to go up and hug people. Not that I walk around hugging everybody, but, you know.
Yeah. I mean, it's don't want to seem standoffish, but on the other hand, also do not want to spread or catch the COVID. So, yikes.
No, and everybody understands that. I think for all the people out there who never liked hugging anyway, this is a dream come true.
There are those folks, yeah.
Yeah, there are.
That's
those
true.
Folks.
Yeah. So you gotta remember the silver linings where you can find them. I guess I don't know, but
yeah. And I know people continue to struggle economically right now. You know, as businesses are still not fully opened or may not have as many staff on, and so that's hard too. So the mental health aspect of this continues to be difficult with some isolation economic stress. And so really encouraging people to do what they need to do to take care of themselves and to reach out. Some people getting in touch with people they haven't gotten in touch with in a long time and doing more phone calls and Zoom.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Do what you need to do. Yeah.
Right,
and ask
right.
for help when you need it. Say, hey, I really need to talk to somebody. And I feel like people are really stepping up and helping each other that way as well.
That's great. I wanted to check in with you, put on your sort of epidemiological hat here for a moment or about the disease itself. Is the coronavirus changing, or are there new strains of it out there? I see reports from time to time that it's becoming more prevalent among young people. What is the latest on the sort of biology here?
Sure. What we know about it so far is that it's a very slow mutating virus, which is good news. It means that as you work on a vaccine, you don't have to necessarily fear that by the time you've got one, it's no longer applicable. So that's good news. It appears to be slow mutating. It continues to present in the way that we've learned in the past few months. More people are getting corona, but that's also because we're testing more people. So, as our Supreme Leader mentioned, if you don't test, you would never know. More testing certainly allows us to know more, and so we're seeing that more people, young people, are getting it. Not as severe the illness in young people, and that is good. The downside to that is then if you're a young person, you may feel a little invincible and forget that when you're out, even the person you're next to, if they're a fellow young person, even if they get it, that might not seem like a big deal either, except that somebody is going to be touching somebody else or reaching out who is more vulnerable, and that's where it starts to become more dangerous. Of course, there are some young people getting it who also become very ill, so I don't mean to suggest that no one young would become very ill. We're certainly seeing that, especially in states with higher numbers. I mean, you think about Arizona, 4,000 cases. That's not 4,000 people over 80. You know, that's a range of people, and probably some of those, even in the younger groups, may have a significant illness with this. So we are lucky in Vermont, but it's not just luck. I think it's good leadership, and I think it's good behavior on the part of Vermonters, and again, really encouraging people. We don't want to end up where these other states are, so as much as we can do, and the health department has really stepped up to try to contain these outbreaks, not just the health department, but plenty of partners. You know, EMS steps up for testing. Police have really stepped up. I just think partners, businesses, everyone's really coming forward.
You know, you mentioned the strategy of keeping your numbers down by using less testing, which I think has been pretty widely discredited. But I saw something online kind of spoofing that and saying, if you're worried about summer heat waves, just throw your thermometers away.
I was being facetious, and I know that you're not supposed to do that on radio because people can't see your face, but no.
Certainly.
I think what I meant is when you don't test, then you may be surprised when you start testing and feel like it's new that young people are getting it. It's not new. They were getting it the whole time. But now that we're testing more, we're seeing it. Although in Vermont, even among our asymptomatic people, we are not seeing high numbers. We can test 600 or 700 people at a clinic who come in asymptomatically, not because they're in a higher risk group necessarily. They're just coming in and they're curious to get testing. And there are times when we test 600 or 700 people and we have zero positive results. So
that must be a good day.
And there's plenty of days like that. We just had a clinic in a nearby town where we were concerned there had been an outbreak, and we tested an additional 250 people, and none of them came back positive. So even among asymptomatics right now, our testing is showing a much lower infection rate, and that's unique in Vermont a little bit right now because we worked so hard. That could change, of course.
Is the test still that Q-tip way up your nose, or is there some other less uncomfortable methods now?
It's still a Q-tip up your nose, but we are now introducing, where we can, because we have limited supplies, nasal swabs. So the pharyngeal nasal swab goes way up, although not as painful as, you know, you would think if you relax into it. But the nasal one now just goes, closer to the front of the nares. And so we're starting to use that for particularly the elderly, because we don't want it to be uncomfortable for them, for children.
Okay.
And for others, and we're hoping eventually that we can shift over entirely, because it also requires less protective equipment. So we got a shipment in, so we're starting on that and hoping to do more of that.
Tracy Dolan has been my guest, Deputy Commissioner of Vermont Department of Health. We're about out of time, but I thank you very much for joining me this morning.
Okay, thank you very much. Take care.
You too. We're going to go to our top of the hour break for some CBS News. A couple words from our sponsors. When we return, we'll be speaking with one of our correspondents from Axios. And then Dan Richardson, legal analyst, will join us in the second hour for a discussion about that big ruling out of the U.S. Supreme Court yesterday. Stay with us, folks.
We're opening upstairs at the Warren Store. Following CDC guidelines, we will allow 3 people at a time from 10 to 4 Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, and 11 to 3 Monday and Thursday until further notice. Or you can email Lori, L-O-R-I, at warrenstore.com to make an appointment. There's lots of great summer clothing at 50% off outside and new spring merchandise upstairs. Please wear a mask. We have disposables, and we will be selling organic wired ones from Product Think Tank. We'd love to see you. Stay safe. Main Street, Warren Village.
Now back to the Dave Graham Show on WDEV, FM, and AM.
Thanks for staying with us into our second hour on this June 30th, 2020, Tuesday morning. And we have one of our correspondents from Axios, a terrific online news service, joining us this morning to talk about some of the big national headlines occurring out there. And I believe it's Ursula Pernow. Is that right?
Yes, sir.
All righty. Thank you for joining me. And wanted to check in with you about a few things. One is that we were just talking with our deputy health commissioner here in Vermont about Vermont's relatively good control over the coronavirus pandemic within our own small state's borders. We've had 56 deaths. I think we've had a total of 1,208 cases since the pandemic began of people testing positive for the coronavirus. That I was blown away to think that that's the entire pandemic for Vermont. More than three times as many people tested positive apparently on Sunday in Arizona. 4,000 people, 4,000 new cases in Arizona. Obviously a much bigger state than Vermont, but even given that, it's just it kind of puts this whole thing in some kind of weird perspective. What are we hearing out there nationally? Are a lot of states starting to put the brakes on their reopening efforts?
So a lot of states are seeing spikes since reopening that for a while were being attributed to increased testing by state health departments and local health officials. But now it's really coming back to just people going to bars, people going to restaurants, people not always wearing masks. There's no national mask mandate, of course, and some states have started to put in mask mandates, but in a lot of areas, including Florida, which is a virus hotspot, it's per municipality or county or city. So a couple of states have started to walk back their reopening. Florida, Texas, New Jersey, Arizona yesterday, shutting down gyms and bars and nightclubs for a month. So it's saying that these governors and these health officials are taking a step back, pausing the reopening, trying to curb this sudden spike so we're not facing a tentative second wave as soon as originally planned. Of course, that had originally been sort of foreseen for later this year during the winter months, during the cold months, but it's coming around now and people are trying to lock it down.
Yeah, it's interesting that in certain places you think at a very kind of basic and practical level, it's just difficult to wear a mask while you're engaged in the normal activities you do in the place. I think of gyms now. It's tough to be on a treadmill or a elliptical trainer or something and have a mask on. You're breathing pretty hard typically, and you're sweating, and it's just that's hard. So I'm sure that those places are most prone, more prone perhaps than, I don't know, a supermarket, another place a lot of people go, and there could be, you know, quite a number of people around. Easier to wear a mask in an air-conditioned supermarket than at a gym. And the same thing even at a bar. I mean, at a bar, you're talking and you're drinking. You're going to put a glass to your lips. You know, you got to lift your mask every time you do that. I don't know. I mean, is that part of the issue with those sort of being the tip of the spear here, gyms and bars?
So bars, I think, are an issue because younger people have been leaning into the reopening at an increased rate compared to older populations, more vulnerable populations. And the bar shut down, I know, in Texas and in Florida, was largely geared towards telling 20-somethings and 30-somethings who are becoming the new positive population for the coronavirus to go home. But masks themselves are definitely difficult at gyms. There are some exceptions and state orders for if you're exercising or if you're jogging, because it is different than if you're in a supermarket, like you said. But overall, the public health data is so foreshadowing that masks will be the defining factor on if we are able to curb this spread, to have an effective reopening, or if we're going to see numbers increase the same way we saw earlier this year, causing the stay-at-home orders that, of course, nobody wants to go through again.
Yeah, I mean, that was really tough. I mean, there were times in March and April when my little town of Vermont reminded me of, East Berlin after before the wall came down. I was over there in the mid-80s and making some visits to East Berlin, and it was pretty dead. You know, the scene was just not a happening thing. So, I wonder whether there are indications at all that the second sort of wave of tightening up and closing down and so on, is it starting to have an effect yet, or is it too soon to tell?
So former FDA Commissioner Scott Gottlieb actually went on CBS on Sunday and talked about this, and he said that we are not going to see the aggressive actions that governors and lawmakers are taking in these virus hotspots take effect for several weeks. You think about in New York, they imposed their stay-at-home order, yet their peak of coronavirus cases came several weeks later because it takes so long to mitigate that spread for tests to come in. Of course, there's a two-week incubation period. You can get the virus and not know for 14 days. And so we're starting to see these shutdowns come in, we're not really going to be able to see if they bring us back down to the numbers and the places that public health officials want us to be for quite some time.
Hey, I wanted to shift gears if we can, Ursula, and ask you about another big story which has been bubbling along for the last few days, and that concerns what did the president know and when did he know it stuff on the alleged Russian payment of bounties for killing of U.S. troops by Taliban and affiliated groups in Afghanistan. And it appears now that there's a lot of pretty solid reporting out there indicating that the president at least was offered a daily brief back in February, I believe it was. How's this thing shaking out now?
So House Democrats are going to be looking at the situation this morning and especially focusing on that question of did President Trump know about these bounties? Of course, he claimed he was never briefed on it, saying that his intelligence officials didn't think the information was credible and therefore did not relay it to him. But you're right, there's some top-notch reporting coming out showing that he was offered a daily intelligence brief on it at least once, and that top White House officials were aware in early 2019 of the alleged bounties on U.S. troops. Officials are still investigating whether any Americans actually died as a result of those bounties, but it definitely is a tense moment for the Russia-U.S. relations, and of course, that's already a complex thing when you're talking about the Trump presidency, allegations of Russian collusion in 2016, and President Trump's relationship with Vladimir Putin is always a hotly watched issue. And so the House Democrats that are looking at it today are going to be, I'm sure, very diligent and impose a lot of scrutiny on that question of did Trump know about these Russian bounties on U.S. troops.
Is anybody speculating that this could be a case similar to a kid who's not paying attention in class, and maybe he's sitting in a room and somebody was going through the daily brief for him, saying, "Oh, by the way, one of the things we're finding is X," and and he's got his attention on something completely different, or I remember kids in school who were sitting in the back row flipping quarters off their elbows. I don't know if it was quite that bad, but you see what I mean? He's someone who's not known for being a really diligent student of his daily briefs.
Yeah, absolutely. There definitely is previous reporting that indicates that President Trump has not always been the most diligent in looking at the details of his daily briefs, being engaged in those, especially when you compare to the records and documentation of previous presidents, how they engaged with their daily briefings. So that's certainly a question. President Trump can be rather lackadaisical in some things. Look at the White Power video that was retweeted from his account over the weekend. At the beginning of the video, you could hear very clearly people screaming "White Power," yet the president claiming that he did not hear that. It very well could be an instance of the president was briefed, but he just didn't necessarily catch that detail.
Yeah, about that White Power video, it seems to be the latest in a series of instances where the president does things or says things which could be most kindly interpreted to mean little or nothing, or more darkly interpreted, and I'm thinking here of, for instance, the famous visit to Michigan where he was extolling the bloodlines of noted Nazi sympathizer Henry Ford. And everybody understands that what an issue or what a sort of a talisman or whatever blood is for the Nazis, the bloodlines and so on. To go there and use that language and praise that guy, Trump's defenders will tell you, really meant nothing. He just was there, extolling the foundering of a company he was visiting. And so this one apparently means nothing because he didn't catch the chanting at the beginning of the video. There have been other instances like this, which could be, in one interpretation, regarded as signals to, sort of the white power, white supremacist movement in the United States, or they could be regarded as much ado about nothing. How do you think these things are they adding up? Are they being connected by anybody? What's the word out there?
Trump himself, I think, is just very much an eye of the beholder president. His backers are going to, like you said, say it was a slip, he didn't hear that part. It's not connected. It is not a part of some grander scheme, and Democrats are going to lean into it. You can almost guarantee that elements of that White Power video, of other slips, of his Michigan trip, of all of those things put together are going to be things that Joe Biden capitalizes on in his race against Trump in November. But at the end of the day, Trump is slipping in the polls. He is struggling to sell this economic comeback line that he was counting on for his 2020 bid. He's got a tough go ahead of him if you're looking at it state of play right now against Biden in November. And the catch of that all is really that Biden isn't doing much. He's largely staying out of the spotlight, focusing on virtual town halls. He's not planning rallies again. There's this narrative that Biden's been hiding out in his basement, but it's working for him. So it's sort of a, if it's not broke, don't fix it argument from the Democratic camp.
Yep. I don't know if he's growing roses in his basement, but it could be a sort of weird non-incumbent rose garden strategy. Who the heck knows? So. Hey, Ursula, for now, I got to get, but I really appreciate you spending some time with us this morning. It is always good to talk with you Axios folks, and we are grateful.
Yeah, of course. Happy to be on.
All righty. We'll talk to you soon. We're going to find out what happened yesterday at the U.S. Supreme Court on the long-running controversy over abortion, legal access to abortion in the United States of America. And with us to help sort all this out is Dan Richardson, a regular guest on the Dave Graham Show, who provides our legal analysis for us. He's very kind to help us out with all that. And Dan is a very active lawyer in Montpelier, former president of the Vermont Bar Association. And we enjoy having Dan on, as we do again this morning. Dan, thank you so much this morning for joining me.
No, my pleasure, Dave.
So we have a very interesting another case out of the Supreme Court yesterday, which might be a bit of a surprise to some casual watchers of the court, but those who study it more carefully, I think, have a fairly good understanding of what happened and why. So walk us through it. What did the court say regarding abortion, and how does it fit into a larger picture?
Sure. So what the case was, this came out of Louisiana, and it dealt with a statute that the state legislature had passed, which required abortion providers to have admitting privileges at a hospital to function. And that if you did not have at least one doctor on staff that had admitting privileges at a local hospital, you know, you couldn't operate an abortion clinic. So it didn't outlaw abortion per se. But it had that effect. And these are often what are called by, Planned Parenthood and pro-choice groups as trap laws, which they're not on their face making abortion illegal, but they do outlaw in practice. And the fact here is that the admitting process and privileges was particularly difficult because abortion providers don't tend to send patients to hospitals. It's an outpatient service most of the time, and there's a very, very small percentage that do go actually to the hospital or need that kind of additional medical care. And what makes this, and so it's not as if the hospitals are saying, because you provide abortion, we're not going to give you admitting privileges. It's more a function of numbers, which is doctors who have admitting privileges have to admit so many patients per month or per year as a sort of quota to keep their admitting privileges. And in this case, the abortion providers just simply aren't providing the high enough numbers. So most of them cannot get admitting privileges to the local hospitals.
Let me stop you and ask for a moment. Do you know if most abortion clinics have physicians on staff?
Yes, most do. They have to have a physician.
Okay, so then, and the next threshold then is does this physician have admitting privileges at the local hospital? And because they're working, their basic workday is to work at the abortion clinic. And very few patients go from the abortion clinic to the hospital. There are not enough admissions to get this doctor privileges at the local hospital, right?
That's right. That's right.
Okay.
And in part, I mean, think of it as like any other outpatient medical service, which, you know, if you go, and I don't mean to equate the two fully, but just for the very limited purpose of describing it this way, which is if you have, dermatologists, most dermatologists that are MDs don't necessarily have admitting privileges unless they do surgery. And that's because most of their work is done in an outpatient clinic, and they do not have to send their patients to the hospital. So, it's where within the medical hierarchy that they fit. And what was found at the district court level was that this did not serve a particularly legitimate medical purpose, which is it did not make the care better. It did not improve the health services offered. This seemed to be a restriction under the guise of that, that was intended really to be a roadblock to being able to provide these services altogether. And under the framework that Planned Parenthood versus Casey, which was an early 90s Supreme Court decision, which is has surpassed Roe v. Wade really as the standard for abortion care, they found it to be an undue burden on the woman's right to an abortion in that early portion of a pregnancy. And it did not meet a compelling state interest. And so they struck it down. Now, why this was a surprise here today, yesterday in the Supreme Court, is that, you know, you have a majority now of the Supreme Court of justices who, on the record in various cases, have said, we wish to strike, you know, we don't agree with Roe v. Wade. We think it was a wrongly decided case. We think there is not this inherent constitutional, or at least we question it, and we wonder whether there is this inherent sort of constitutional right to an abortion. But you have the result that you got yesterday, and to be clear, what happened yesterday was there was a plurality opinion. So the way the court came down was 4-1-4, meaning the liberal majority of the court, or liberal wing of the court, the four justices, voted to affirm the district court, which is to strike down this Louisiana law. You had the four conservative justices saying, reverse the district court. We think this law meets constitutional muster. And then you have Chief Justice Roberts, who votes to uphold the district court, but does so on very, very limited grounds and does not join the plurality's opinion, but writes his own separate opinion as to why he votes the way he does. And what's interesting about Justice Roberts is that he's an institutionalist, and why he voted the way he did is the Louisiana law is actually not new. About 4 years ago, the Supreme Court dealt with the exact same law coming out of Texas, and mm-hmm. they wrote a decision striking down that law as an undue burden on a woman's right to an abortion under Planned Parenthood versus Casey. And the Louisiana law was the exact same law. Now, usually you don't have this type of situation, but what happened was, in the meantime, Justice Kennedy, who was the fifth vote on the Texas decision, and I should be clear that Justice Roberts was in the dissenting minority on that decision. He thought that the Texas law met the constitutional requirements, and he was more than happy to let it pass. But Justice Kennedy voted, and this became the majority opinion. And so the Louisiana law was basically a sort of redo with the exact same law, thinking that with Kennedy gone and Kavanaugh now on the court, they had the five votes to overturn it.
Yep.
But Roberts was unwilling to do that because of stare decisis, which is the doctrine that the U.S. Supreme Court often mentions, but sometimes does not always follow, which says we tend not to revisit settled cases, which is we are bound by our prior decisions, and we only revisit them under very specific and very limited situations. And so, so for Roberts, he basically said, I'm not revisiting a case we settled 4 years ago. I disagreed with it then. I don't necessarily agree with it now, but I'm also not going to upend the court because that's our doctrine, and we let these things, sit. We don't invite people to constantly re-challenge settled law. It's not good for the country. It's not good for the system. It's not good for the court.
Yeah, it's very interesting that, I mean, Roberts could theoretically, and probably is by some, being accused of like a flip-flop. But this is certainly a doctrine that I learned about in school, this stare decisis, this idea that we don't swing back and forth and overturn former previous decisions here on the court. We kind of stick to our guns over time. So that's interesting development.
Right. Now, what's interesting, of course, is that I think Roberts lays out in his decision some question as to whether he would not, he might be more willing to revisit some of the reasoning of Planned Parenthood versus Casey, as well as possibly some of the fundamental issues of Roe v. Wade. Now, what we don't know is how far Roberts is willing to go. It's quite clear that the four-member minority dissenting decision on this case is probably willing to revisit a lot of these issues.
Yep.
But
hey, Dan Richardson, we need to take a brief break here on the Dave Graham Show for some bottom-of-the-hour news, a couple words from our sponsors. Let's continue our conversation on the other side. Folks, we will be back shortly.
We're opening upstairs at the Warren Store. Following CDC guidelines, we will allow 3 people at a time from 10 to 4 Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, and 11 to 3 Monday and Thursday until further notice. Or you can email Lori, L-O-R-I, at warrenstore.com to make an appointment. There's lots of great summer clothing at 50% off outside and new spring merchandise upstairs. Please wear a mask. We have disposables, and we will be selling organic wired ones from Product Think Tank. We'd love to see you. Stay safe. Main Street, Warren Village.
It's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV FM and AM.
We are back, and we're talking with Dan Richardson, our legal analyst, and he is talking with us about the big Supreme Court ruling yesterday in which the court declined to uphold a Louisiana law that would have made it more difficult for women in that state to obtain abortions by essentially placing new restrictions on abortion clinics, requiring that physicians on staff there would have to have admitting privileges at local hospitals, which is something many abortion clinic physicians do not have because they have very few cases that end up going to the hospital, so they don't admit people. And that is just a feature of that that part of the healthcare world. And Dan Richardson, I must say that this whole situation here with the Supreme Court's ruling must be very frustrating, I would think, to ardent abortion opponents out there, which there are many in the United States. I think they thought with the appointments of Neil Gorsuch, first the election of President Trump, and then the appointments of Neil Gorsuch and Brett Kavanaugh, that they might, finally have turned the corner on this issue. But it's not always that easy, right?
It isn't, and that's been the history of the Supreme Court and abortion. I think the Supreme Court has consistently frustrated both sides with their abortion decisions since 1973, and certainly the last time their anticipations were this high was in the early 90s when Planned Parenthood versus Casey was decided, because then newly appointed Justice Thomas was expected to join Kennedy and others to overturn Roe v. Wade. And instead, you have Justice O'Connor changing the standard, lowering it in some respects, but largely keeping it intact. And so, this is the next sort of great sea change that I think there was an anticipation that, this decision could have gone anywhere from a very narrow rollback of abortion rights to something broader. And certainly some of the jurisprudence that Justice Kavanaugh has authored on the D.C. Circuit, as well as some of the statements by Gorsuch and the others, have indicated that they're in favor of, you know, that they don't see the constitutional basis. And I should be clear, when we talk about abortion at the court, it's very easy to mix policy with some of the constitutional standards. And there's no doubt that if you polled a lot of these justices, especially the ones in the conservative wing, they are probably personally against abortion and maybe, you know, politically so. But a lot of their reasoning and jurisprudence is founded upon this constitutional question of, is there a fundamental right? Did the founders intend, and do the documents themselves support this idea of abortion? And this goes back, I mean, this goes back to the 70s in which the Roe v. Wade court found a right to abortion in the Constitution that was really in some ways the pinnacle of their more liberal interpretation and of a living Constitution and an evolving Constitution where you have rights of privacy that aren't necessarily articulated but are found in what are famously referred to as the penumbras of the Constitution, which is to say, mm-hmm. when you have life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that includes privacy necessarily as one of the shaded in areas covered by those big umbrellas. And, you know, I think what happens a lot of times in these abortion cases is you get into some of this, it fundamentally pits a lot of these constitutional interpretive theories against each other. Coupled with the fact that, you know, for the last 40, almost 50 years, this debate has dominated in one yeah. form or another a great deal of political races and policy.
Yeah. Hey, let's bring in a couple of listeners who are on the line. Let's go to Ruth in Sheldon. Good morning, Ruth.
Yes, I think it's fair to point out that every other surgical outpatient service in Louisiana has to have hospital admitting privileges. So this is an exception for abortion. I object to his saying that most abortion clinics have doctors presiding over the abortions. That certainly is not the case in Vermont. Anybody can do an abortion, and they cannot be held accountable for any damage that they do. They cannot be sued. They cannot be stopped. You're not protecting women when you allow improper health care for women. And it's a disgrace. This Supreme Court decision is a disgrace. It is not protecting women and their health. And abortion is a surgical procedure, and it does cause complications. They're never reported because the woman goes to the hospital and the abortion clinic doesn't take care of the complications. They're not reported as complications. And then the hospital reports them as something else. So there's a lot wrong with the abortion industry in the United States, and they're not taking into consideration women's health.
Okay, Ruth, thank you for the call. Let's go to Eileen in Jericho. Good morning, Eileen.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. The previous caller said it better than I could. That was one of my points. But I want to also address the stare decisis. I'm sorry if I'm not saying it right. There have been other issues in our country's history where these abuses, really, you know, that have been blessed by the Supreme Court have been overturned, you know, like slavery. And I think the one, sterilization laws. I mean, there have been some pretty, the things that we think now as just incredibly inhumane. And those things have been. And I believe that abortion is in this realm. I mean, we're taking the life of a human being. And to me, that seems justified if something's going to be overturned. And I think, you know, it's just ironic that right now all these statues are being torn down of people who supported slavery. We look at those people, you know, as those leaders as we don't like that part of our history. And I think this is going to be another case in 100 years, especially now that science, you know, can look into the womb. You can see exactly what we're doing and the humanity of that victim. And someday we're going to look back and this, you know, Supreme Court people at Sport are going to be on the wrong side of history.
Okay, well, Eileen, I got to go, but thank you very much for the call. I think you state your case well. Dan Richardson, Eileen raises an interesting question in my mind, which is, does involve this stare decisis doctrine, this idea that the court only reluctantly reverses its prior decisions. Of course, it has done so a couple of a few times in history. Generally, longer. I mean, tell me if I have this right, but I mean, I'm thinking now of the famous school segregation cases, Plessy versus Ferguson, which I think was in the 1890s, which said that that if you offered, you could have separate but equal schools, basically. And then the Brown versus Board of Education, 1954, which said that really hasn't worked out, and that we don't have, once you separate your schools, you're not going to have equal schools effectively, and therefore school integration is the way to go. 60 years or so elapsed between those two decisions. Does it take that long for a reversal like that to happen? And is stare decisis more likely to be the order of the day when you're dealing with decisions that come as close in time as this Texas decision and this Louisiana decision?
Sure. Those are good questions. I mean, a couple just sort of first minor technical corrections. Of course, slavery was not reversed by the Supreme Court. That was undone by the 13th Amendment. That took a constitutional change. And of course, famously, the U.S. Supreme Court upheld slavery prior to the Civil War. And Plessy versus Ferguson was actually about railroad cars and the idea that you could have segregated railroad cars as long as they were separate but equal. But you're right that in the larger point of Brown versus Board of Education overturned that separate but equal doctrine. And I think that may be what certainly if somebody was, looking to curb abortion, what they could take away as some comfort from this decision, which is that Chief Justice Roberts does telegraph that, you know, while he's not willing to overturn this particular sort of smaller piece, he is willing to revisit that larger piece. And that's obviously the irony of stare decisis that I was starting to talk about before the break, which is that I think what you have is the court is not willing to revisit these small things, but sometimes they are willing to revisit these larger things. And certainly, you know, if you think about abortion and the ongoing issues that it has engendered, it does. It is one of those issues that I think people's thought evolve upon. And just even going back to the original Roe v. Wade, I mean, Roe v. Wade was itself premised on a lot of 1970s era medical knowledge. Famously, the author of that, Justice Blackmun, spent a summer writing his decision at the Mayo Clinic up in Minnesota, where he was from. Mm-hmm. Doing research on, women's health and medicine at the time. So in a lot of the language of the original Roe v. Wade decision really reflects that thought, that idea of the third trimester and point of viability was truth in 1973. And that's changed a little bit. And so, you know, when you have a decision in which that is baked into some of the underlying thinking, It does invite that sort of rethinking. And the court, I could see, particularly this court, because you technically have five votes on there right now that would that have at one time or another expressed a desire to revisit Roe v. Wade or Planned Parenthood versus Casey. And so, yep. You know, it may be something where Chief Justice Roberts is saying, as an institutionalist, I'm not going to do this. This is really a very naked and very ugly attempt to exploit a change on the court. And just as I wouldn't want this to happen if this had been sort of switched from the other side, I'm not going to do it here. And to that extent, you know, Chief Justice Roberts is being consistent with what he said he would be when he was appointed to the court, which is more umpire than policymaker. Yep. And so the start
calling the balls and strikes.
Exactly. You know, that this is clearly, this is just too nakedly and clearly under the umbrella of the earlier Texas decision. I'm not going to do it. But at the same time, you know, he doesn't, and that's part of the reason why he doesn't join the majority, I mean, the plurality decision, is that I think he is willing to and all but invites, you know, rethinking Planned Parenthood versus Casey, in part because it is in of itself a unique standard under the constitutional law, this undue burden on a woman's right to an abortion is a unique standard. There are no other constitutional standards that are quite articulated that way. And it's something that's evolved over time. And, you know, you could see someone like Roberts, who, while is an institutionalist, is also someone who is a textualist and, you know, probably is, at the end of the day, offended on some level about the nature in which, you know, this decision has arisen and how it has come to be articulated. That said, you know, the other issue, and you know, when you think about the history of the court, you know, Roberts in a lot of ways is a disciple of Rehnquist. And when Rehnquist had the opportunity to overturn the Miranda decision, which he famously did not like and did not believe was grounded in the Constitution, he didn't, in part because it had become so permeated into American culture and so accepted that overturning it was just something that the court couldn't bring itself to do, and Rehnquist couldn't bring himself to do because it had become so embedded into our understanding of what our constitutional rights were. So, you know, to say this is going to happen this way, I wouldn't necessarily start making wagers with the 401k on outcomes.
Okay. Well, and of course, with the Miranda decision, I mean, once it started being read on Dragnet, you couldn't change it. There was just no way. But
that's right. Jack Webb sealed Miranda.
You have the right to remain silent. Anything that you say can will be used against you, et cetera. So, hey, let's bring in a caller. Rama's on the line from Williamstown. Good morning, Rama.
Good morning. This is a question about, because you brought the word unique was brought up, and I think the you know, people like to try to bring in slavery with the abortion issue and such, but the relationship between a mother and the fetus that she has within her is a unique relationship that is not paralleled anywhere else in the world that I'm aware of, as far as human beings go anyway, in that, you know, you have a direct biological connection there, and in essence, the growing fetus and developing into an infant is a biological process that is, you know, it's directly connected with the mother's biological processes and her using her body to further the development of the fetus. So I wonder if the courts have ever dealt with that side of the equation at all. And I'll hang up and listen. Thanks.
Thank you, Rama. What can you tell us, Dan?
Sure. Well, I mean, back in the original Roe v. Wade decision, and like I indicated, Justice Blackmun became very interested in that relationship. And that's really at the heart of this whole issue, which is no one disputes that each individual has a right to seek medical care as they see fit. You know, we have no laws prohibiting people from going to an herbalist instead of a doctor. You know, there are certain public health exceptions on the fringes, and I'll just point that out before somebody does, you know, such as immunizations. But by and large, we do recognize a certain autonomy of people to seek medical care. But, you know, what lies at the heart of abortion is the fact that you have a woman and you have a fetus. And the question is, at the point of life, as people choose to define it, what are the rights of that unborn child? And when do they become vested such that they're to be recognized and protected. What Roe v. Wade tries to take that that relationship, it puts it on a point of viability, which is the fetus's rights start to become vested once the fetus can survive outside of the womb, once it stops being, you know, functionally a part of the woman's body and dependent upon it for life. And for 1973, that was really the first trimester, was a woman's rights trumped the fetuses for abortion purposes completely, that the state could not make any law that would limit an abortion in the first trimester. And the third trimester was where the fetus's rights were fully vested, such that states could make limitations, and that, you know, health of the mother or survival of both the mother and the fetus were, you know, something that would be the key decision factors. And the second trimester became the sort of battleground, at which point, you know, there were allowance of laws that might make restrictions on whether or not, you know, an abortion could take place, and the state could require consent or other issues, other standards. Casey changed that a little bit and made it about undue burdens, but did retain that fundamental point of viability. But of course, by the early 90s, the point of viability was being pushed back earlier and earlier, you know, with premature babies being born and surviving in incubators. That point of viability was getting earlier. And so, you know, that's been one of the struggles here, is that Roe v. Wade is ultimately anchored on this idea of viability, which changes as technology changes. And this is ultimately the question of, Where do we vest people's rights? And obviously, you know, if you're Catholic, it's at the point of conception. For other people, it's, you know, at the point of, you know, much later, either birth or right before, or some point in viability. You know, and obviously, people will often make straw man arguments and try and put the other side's point in the most, you know, ridiculous light possible. But the fact of the matter is that, you know, there is this societal debate. And
well, here's a question I have about that. I wanted to run this by you, Dan. Let's look at the government's role for a minute. And you know, let's imagine that, and I haven't settled on this, by the way, 100%. I'm just sort of toying with it and trying to figure out whether it makes any sense at all. Let's look at the government's role as opposed to the where in the development the fetus is right at the moment. Traditionally, in moral philosophy, the government stepped in as people, or was created as people exited what is what used to be called the state of nature. You know, originally human beings lived in this world where they had no government protection at all. Nobody did, and you basically fended for yourself out there in the woods or the savannas or wherever you were, and did the best you could, and life was sometimes nasty, brutish, and short, as Thomas Hobbes put it, and that was the way it went. Imagine further for a moment that the last state of nature extant in the modern world is the womb, and that it's exiting the womb when one... you can say all you want about how much developed and how viable, et cetera, but it's on exiting the womb that one exits the state of nature, gets a birth certificate, the first documentation of their citizenship, effectively, and then moves into the realm where he or she is protected by the government. Does that make any sense at all?
Well, a little bit, but I guess the thing that I would push back on as that as an argument is that, you know, the social contract that you're describing isn't necessarily signed by all of us. We exist within it with sort of a zone of a social contract, and, you know, the womb exists within that social contract. And just simply because the person in the womb hasn't necessarily been informed of the social contract doesn't mean that they're any less subject to it, because the woman is herself within that zone. I think part of, you know, oftentimes this comes down to the question of what is life, and is there a priori kind of existence such that rights would be reasonably imposed. You know, we have a scale of legal implications for people throughout their life. For example, children cannot form contracts or be bound by contracts because they don't have the capacity to do so.
Mm-hmm.
And oftentimes the abortion debate about this is, if we have a cluster of cells, whether they be a fetus or stem cells or whatever human cells they be, do those things have rights? And do they have rise to the level of existence such that we deem them to have rights, as opposed to any other material on Earth, such that we would include them within our zone of social contract? And that's ultimately where reasonable people disagree.
Where
they have those debates. But I guess I would just push back on the idea that, you know, I certainly understand the idea that this is sort of a wild. The womb is somewhat outside of society, but I don't think so. I mean, I think ultimately it is within, and that's where the government has the authority to regulate it, is that, you know, the woman exists within the social contract, and we, you know, some people would see the idea of a social contract as not committing murder. And if you mm-hmm. believe that the fetus is in and of itself a life form, a human life form that is entitled to full rights of a human being, then it does follow that those can be regulated, because you're talking about, you know, the crime of you know, some people would put it bluntly as homicide or feticide. And, you know, this is the fundamental question, because if it is just a cluster of cells, just assuming for the moment that it is just not a human being, but is a pre-human being, is just genetic material, then it's not murder. It's not homicide. And there's no justifiable reason to regulate it other than the same reasons we regulate any of the medical profession.
Hey, Dan, you know what? I hate to do this, but I don't think we're going to resolve this today. And I also think we're about out of time. Hey, Dan Richardson has been my guest. He's our legal analyst on the Dave Graham Show here at WDEV FM and AM. Thanks for listening, folks. And we'll be back tomorrow with another edition of our program. And we wish you a good afternoon. Stay healthy out there. Wash your hands. Wear your mask, etc.